ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, great show this week. I have one of the top ETF gurus set to join me. Surprisingly, she hasn't been on the podcast before. Elizabeth Kashner, Director of ETF Research at FactSet, who they actually power a lot of the data you find at ETF.com. So Elizabeth recently wrote what I thought was an excellent piece on the entire ETF fee landscape. And some of the data she had here was pretty mind-boggling. I'm going to walk through this when Elizabeth joins me. But we're going to have a conversation around ETF fees, the fee war, the role larger firms like Vanguard and iShares are playing. We'll look at fees in ESG ETFs, active ETFs. This should be really interesting. And then I'm going to get her takeaways from last week's Inside ETFs conference as well, where I've got to tell you, Elizabeth actually dressed up as Wonder Woman. So I've seen Inside ETFs referred to as Comic-Con for ETFs. Elizabeth bridged those two worlds for us in Florida. So we'll definitely have some fun visiting about that as well. Now, also on the show will be Tony Wenzel, co-founder and president of Brandometry. They power the index behind the Brand Value ETF, which attempts to own companies that have extremely strong brands that the market might be undervaluing right now. It's a novel approach, so we'll get into the details of that. But I'm going to start this week by talking January ETF flows and new launches with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, great seeing you in Florida last week. Honestly, it seems like that was several weeks ago. That conference is always such a blur to me.
Really is. Good to see you, Nate. Congratulations to Chief Nation.
Well, thank you. And actually, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to lead off the show with that, but then I thought, you know, I'm not ESPN here, right? Nobody wants my sports hot takes. But since you broached the topic, no, it was an amazing game. The town is buzzing. There's a parade tomorrow, so it should be a lot of fun.
Congrats.
Okay, so let's start with January ETF flows. I was a bit surprised given everything going on in the markets between Iran and the impeachment and the coronavirus. ETFs pulled in like $50 billion in inflows with a decent chunk of that going into equities. Did that surprise you at all?
Well, I'll tell you, the trend is your friend. We saw a lot of momentum going into ETFs and flows in the fourth quarter, which you typically see at the end of the year. But what's interesting is last year we actually saw outflows of $2 billion in January, and contrast that with $50 billion in inflows. The market's at an all-time high. There's really no reason not to invest right now. And the other thing I think we continue to see is fixed income was right behind equity in terms of asset flows. We had $17 billion in U.S. equity and $15 billion in U.S. fixed income. Flows. So that competitive nature is going to be there all year. And the other thing that's interesting, every single asset class of ETFs showed inflows during January, which you typically will see in an inverse or commodity, something will drop, but that wasn't the case. So obviously investors are all in, and at this point it doesn't seem any reason to not invest. The big thing hanging out there, of course, is the coronavirus. That will obviously dampen GDP in China. And the bigger one of the takeaways I got in Florida, talking to some pretty smart fixed income people, we are seeing an impact of the coronavirus on the 10-year Treasury. The rates have been going down, and as rates go down, prices go up. So I think fixed income is going to be a very interesting thing to watch during the next few weeks as this virus plays out.
No, I agree, and especially following a record year in bond ETF flows last year. I think it was one of your analysts, Amit Roy, said yesterday that January was the best month since January 2018, which had like $68 billion in assets. That was the record, or that currently is the record. Something
right.
Also I saw, Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas tweeted out yesterday that ETFs have taken in $142 billion over the past 3 months, which that would be a record if it was a calendar quarter. So it is just amazing because, you know, I felt like last year there were a lot of headline events in the market, but yet we continue to see flows into ETFs. And here we are again, starting off 2020 in similar fashion. I don't know if we can keep up with the pace, but pretty mind-boggling nonetheless. Anything else standing out to you on January ETF flows before we move on?
Yeah, actually I did. I did see that iShares ESG MSCI USA ETF, ESGU, it's an ESG environmental social governance fund, socially responsible, impact investing, whatever you want to call it, had huge flows, almost $2 billion, which was almost a 50% increase in its AUM. So there is definitely a move afoot now. We've been waiting for that snowball to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and I think we're really starting to see some momentum going into ESG funds, and $2 billion into one iShares fund is significant and worth noting.
Well, and of course, that followed the letters from BlackRock CEO Larry Fink. I think some of those flows came the day after those letters were released. Okay, Drew, so let's move on and talk ETF launches. This may surprise some people. Only 12 new ETFs came to market in January, and there were six closures, so a net of only six ETFs. And I tweeted this out over the weekend. The 12 ETFs that launched, listen to this, they have an average expense ratio of nearly 70 basis points. That included three iShares ETFs. So if you take those out, the other nine ETFs had an average fee of nearly 80 basis points. What do you make of that, both in terms of number of launches in January and then where they're being priced?
Well, some of these are kind of boutique ETF issuers. We had a lot of new issuers come along. They're active managers, not in the full sense, but so they're smaller. I don't know if they're bespoken products, but they're not necessarily meant for the mass audience. And in terms of price, I'm kind of a contrarian now. I really don't think the fee war is as big as people think it is. Sure, competitively in the industry, inside baseball, it's a big deal. But people want a product, and if somebody's going to give it to them, and frankly, anything under 1%, considering where we were 20 years ago, a lot of people do not get hung up on that. Sure, there's reasons to, and it's absolutely important, but at the same token, I think what we're going to see with the new SEC rule, we're going to see a lot of products come out that are from small issuers that maybe you've never heard of, but they have people that want a product, and they're giving it to them cheaper than they did before, and to them, it's all relative, so it is cheaper.
Well, and we're going to cover this exact topic with Elizabeth Cashner here in a few moments. I guess, you know, the flip side of that is if you look at flows, I believe something like 80% of flows are going into products with a fee of 20 basis points or less. But, you know, I think back to the conversation you and I actually had in Florida last week, that if you have a real differentiated product, something that can offer value, then, you know, perhaps you can price that higher. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if assets move to those products. You know, there are a few providers out there. First Trust always comes to mind for me that is able to offer products at a much higher price point and still get the flows. But I don't know. I still think fees trump all.
Yeah, it depends who your client is. If it's an institutional client, there's reason for them to pay a little bit more for a product they want specifically. You can even call it direct indexing if you want. But at the same token, if you're trying to sell something to the mass audience or the mass retail audience or to advisors who have a fiduciary responsibility to put their clients in a cheaper product than a competitor, yes, you're absolutely right. But I also think there's a whole new ETF market out there that is not, you know, the Fidelity zero fee target audience. There's an audience out there that is just learning about ETFs and realizing they can get a cheaper vehicle than what they have been using on hedge funds or other institutional vehicles.
What about just the pace of new launches? Last year, that pace was a bit slower. We also saw an increase in closures. Is that just a sign of a maturing industry, or is there anything else to make of that?
It's heartbeats. I guarantee you there's going to be a ton of launches this year. The active managing, the new active managed ETFs are just waiting at the gates. And there's reasons. There's caution. Things have to be laid out. Contract. This is a whole new territory. But there's going to, the floodgates will be open in the active manager area very quickly, very soon.
All right. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, it wasn't a launch, but probably the biggest story in ETFs over the past month or so, which was State Street debuting what I call mini SPY, right? They changed the index on the Spider Portfolio Large Cap ETF, ticker SPLG, to now track the S&P 500. It's priced at 3 basis points. And of course, the most popular ETF in the world is the Spider S&P 500 ETF, ticker SPY. That's at 9.5 basis points. Any quick thoughts on that?
I mean, it's smart by State Street. SPY has always been, why is SPY at 9 basis points when everything else is cheaper? SPY is a trading vehicle for the big boys and women. This is a serious trading tool. It's got $250 billion in assets. Again, no one's getting hung up on SPY. They're getting hung up on the liquidity. They want to be able to literally have no trading spread. SPY, the mini SPY is similar to the mini GLD that was launched about 18 months ago. Basically, what they're doing is trying to bring down both the price, couple basis points, sure, but really the handle, which is the price tag of a share. That's on the street, it's called the handle. So instead of spending, you know, hundreds of dollars on one share, you can spend $15 on the mini SPY. Same with GLB. Instead of buying, you know, $100 of GLB, the mini SPY will give you a percent lower, thus the handle is smaller. To me, I think it's a little bit silly, but that's just the way consumers think. That's why you see car commercials that say $9,999, not $10,000. So price and handle does mean a lot to people. If somebody sees a share price, and frankly, I always think about Amazon, for instance, almost $2,000 a share. People might think, oh, I want to buy Amazon, and then they look at it and go, well, I don't have $2,000 to buy a share. And Berkshire Hathaway did the same thing. So yeah, you will push some people out with a high handle, and you'll bring some people in with a low handle. And we saw this before with iShares when they came out with their core series, cheaper products, smaller handles, pretty much the same product, but just a little different. And you're talking to two different clients. One is retail, and one is the trading community.
I think that's a great point on the lower share price. I think especially for smaller investors, right? Because if you look at SPY, I think it's trading around $325 a share. SPLG is at $40 a share.
Sure.
So if you're a smaller investor and you're trying to build a portfolio, obviously that lower handle makes that easier. Or if you're dollar cost averaging into a portfolio and wherever your
right
accounts are held, they don't offer fractional shares. Again, obviously it's a challenge getting into something like SPY at $325 a share if you don't have a larger portfolio. I do think, and we all know this, going back to the fee war, if you look at the competing products out there, Vanguard S&P 500 ETF, VOO, that's at 3 basis points. The iShares Core S&P 500 ETF, IVV, that's at 4 basis points. If you look at the market share of those two products compared to SPY, even though SPY is the largest ETF in the world, just in terms of net flows, we have seen money coming out of SPY and going into those other products. So I think part of this was obviously strategic on the part of State Street to maybe stop the bleeding there a little bit. We've seen iShares do that with different products, right? When they came out with their core suite, I think of like EFA and EFA. You know, the idea here is to offer a lower price point, lower handle, but I think stem losing some of the market share out of those products.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and I think it is smart. But again, it's one of they're playing into the consumer mentality that people think a cheaper share price is the way to get in. And I would love to see a mini Amazon So you could buy $17 instead of $1,700 a share.
Well, that's fractional shares, which I think will be a big story this year that I'm sure you and I will be covering in detail.
Yep.
Drew, we'll leave it there. Excellent stuff as always. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you for always having me.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. All right, my next guest is Elizabeth Kashner, Director of ETF Research at FactSet, who is a leading provider of financial data and analytics. And Elizabeth manages everything on the ETF side of the equation. So their ETF classifications, ratings, analytics, all of their ETF thought leadership. And I would say you'd be hard-pressed to find many people who understand the inner workings of ETFs and really the overall ETF landscape better than Elizabeth does. And she's now joining me via phone from Berkeley, California. Elizabeth, so great to finally connect. A pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Nate. It's great to be here.
Okay, so a lot I want to cover. We're going to get to an excellent piece you wrote on ETF fees, but I have to start by asking you about the Inside ETFs conference last week. And for people who weren't there, there is a battle of ETF pundits where all the familiar faces in the ETF world, Dave Nodig, Eric Balchunas, Todd Rosenbluth, they all make a pitch for the best new ETF of the past year. Now, your ETF, or actually, I guess, ETFs, they were three new Schwab bond ETFs. But the real story here is, in order to make your case for these, you actually donned a full Wonder Woman outfit. So I have to start by asking you, did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams as you were embarking on your ETF career that you would be on stage in front of a couple thousand people dressed as a Wonder Woman?
You know, Nate, my ability to continue to learn and grow and surprise myself is really a precious thing. So really glad to have had that opportunity, and I may have inadvertently branded myself in the course of it.
Well, I thought it was great, and for people who weren't there, the idea here, this is a fun panel where, again, each of these pundits selects a best new ETF to sort of champion, and along with that, I think props are brought in to kind of make the pitch, or costumes, and that's what you did here. Out of curiosity, how did you zero in on the Schwab bond ETFs as your selection? Because I think some might say those aren't necessarily the most exciting ETFs in the world.
I chose them precisely because they're not exciting. They're useful. And I really chose them with an awareness of the ETF ecosystem. Right? At this point, there are 2,350 ETFs that are listed in the U.S. markets. One fund alone, you know, is not really taking in the full sense of what's going on. What's going on is a complicated dialogue, and I really wanted to capture that, you know, both in picking a fund that is super useful. It's, you know, those funds were in a segment where advisors who are the main audience at ETF.com, have $90 billion of client money as of the end of Q3. So, you know, that's it's hard to argue that these are not useful funds.
Okay, so besides yourself, who do you think should have won the ETF battle of pundits? And let me do this. I'll run through the quick list here, and then you tell me who you think the selection should have been. So, of course, you had the Schwab bond ETFs, Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. He had a uranium mining ETF, ticker URNM. Tom Lydon at ETF Trends ETF Database. He had the Xtrackers S&P 500 ESG ETF, S&PE. Matt Hogan from Bitwise. He had another ESG ETF, the iShares ESG MSCI USA Leaders ETF, SUSL. Morningstar's Ben Johnson had the Avantis US Equity ETF, ticker AVUS. Todd Rosenbluth, who I mentioned last week, actually rapped again to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He had the John Hancock Multi-Factor Media and Communications ETF, ticker JHCS. Cynthia Murphy from ETF.com, who actually won. She had the ProShares S&P Technology Dividend Aristocrats ETF, ticker TDV. Dan Strauss had the Esports and Digital Entertainment ETF, NERD. And then Dave Nodig had the Freedom 100 Emerging Market ETF, ticker FRDM. Who do you think should have been the winner? I'm putting you on the spot.
I have two answers.
Okay, go
no
ahead.
No problem. I've got two answers for you. The first answer is every one of those funds is the kind of thing that an advisor will spend precious time trying to talk their clients out of buying. Those are shiny objects that clients are going to bring to advisors that are not necessarily going to be useful in a long-term strategic asset allocation. My money was actually on Ben Johnson because, again, of the ecosystem argument. Ben chose an actively managed, transparent ETF that's priced at 15 basis points. And I think Ben was actually very targeted in his selection here. One, in terms of the value of transparency, right? We're on the cusp of seeing a lot of non-transparent active ETFs in registration, queuing up for launch, you know, potentially lining up conversions. There's all kinds of things going on there. I think transparency from an investor's point of view has a value, and it's not zero. It might be like an out-of-the-money put that you don't, you know, most of the time expires worthless, but, those don't trade at zero. Those trade at a value. So I think Ben was making that point, and Ben was also making the point that, as everywhere in the ETF universe, cost matters, right? And if American Century can bring out their new transparent active ETF line at 15 basis points, the rest of the industry should be on point and should be paying attention.
Well, it's amazing because investors are certainly paying attention. Those Avantis ETFs have really gathered some assets in a short amount of time. So I think that's going to be a brand to watch moving forward. Avantis, as you mentioned, is under American Century, but they have an ex-DFA CIO who's leading the team there. But Elizabeth, you mentioned the transparency, and of course, last week I thought non-transparent ETFs really stole the show at Inside ETFs. I guess, one, do you agree with that? And then two, any other takeaways from the conference? Anything else catching your attention?
Well, I certainly agree with you that non-transparent active was a huge topic in terms of discussion. We saw a lot of new participants in the conference, you know, really sort of old hands from the mutual fund world trying to come and wrap their heads around, you know, what is this ETF thing? What we didn't see was any dollars, right? And it's going to take some time before we see whether these funds actually attract any client flows and whether those flows are cannibalized or organic.
What are your expectations? Do you think investors are going to gravitate to that non-transparent structure?
I think it's an uphill battle. We've seen very clearly over the course of the past couple of decades that the expected return value add from active management is precisely zero, and that the actual return is lower than that because of fees and also because of transaction costs. So the case for active, you know, is really kind of a case of, well, this time it's going to be different, or my team is really the best. That's a very difficult case to be made. So I think there may be some situations where it's a good fit, but I think it's an awfully hard sell.
No, I agree. I think these are all going to come down to performance. It's really that simple. If the performance isn't there, it's going to be an uphill slog for any non-transparent ETF structure. Any other takeaways from the conference last week before we get to your piece on fees?
Well, certainly ESG was a hot topic, and so was the concept of differentiation that, so many people I talked to who were on the distribution side, on the sales and marketing side, on the strategy side, all said, yeah, we don't really want to compete in the cheap beta space. You know, we think there's a better business to be had by having highly differentiated product. It was kind of like walking through a shoe store full of highly differentiated product.
Well, that's actually a good segue. I was discussing this topic with ETF.com's Drew Voros a little bit earlier. Let's talk about this research piece you recently wrote. It's titled ETF Fee War Hits ESG and Active Management. I highly encourage everyone to check this out. It's at insight.factset.com. And let me just set the table here. You said the top story in 2019 wasn't non-transparent ETFs. It wasn't ESG or marijuana ETFs. It was this continued investor obsession over cost. And as I thought about this, you know, do you think the grind lower in ETF fees is now the expectation? And so maybe that's why it's not getting as much play in the media as before. You know, these other stories are sort of stealing the headlines.
Well, you know, Nate, FactSet has no tools with which to measure expectations. So that's kind of a hard question to answer. I can tell you that it is absolutely the fact on the ground that, you know, we see very clearly year after year, asset class by asset class, strategy by strategy, you know, weighted average expense ratios are falling. So, you know, why the media does what it does regarding any particular topic is a little bit beyond me, but I can tell you in terms of things that we can measure, this is a very clear trend.
Okay, and in terms of things we can measure, let me toss out a few stats you had in the piece, and I'm not sure which one of these is most remarkable. They're all pretty mind-boggling. So fees drop for ETFs, holding nearly 32% of the industry's overall assets in 2019. That included six of the top 10 ETFs. You also said last year's ETF fee cuts returned $95 million to investors over the course of the year. And then this last one is truly hard to believe. You were talking about the weighted average fee. The weighted average fee for the entire ETF industry is now about 20 basis points. I think it may even be just a hair below that. As you hear those stats, where do you think this all ends, right? Will we be at 10 basis points in 5 years? I feel like there has to be a floor somewhere, doesn't there?
Sure. The floor is the marginal cost of production, right? I think what people are perhaps missing here is that financial services industry is an industry like any other, and it is subject to the laws of supply and demand. And the laws of supply and demand state that, you know, in a mature market where, you know, there's near-perfect information that price will eventually be pushed down to the marginal cost of production, right, such that there is a balance between the, you know, the surplus for the producers and the surplus for the consumers. So, you know, while I agree with you that, you know, no asset manager can run a business at zero fees, I think we are in the middle of a grand experiment of scale to see exactly how low that can go.
Okay, so on that note, do you have any concerns about the big three issuers, iShares, Vanguard, State Street? And I guess you could probably toss in somebody like Schwab as well. They're somebody who's vertically integrated, can operate at really high scale. Do you have any concerns that these players are becoming too dominant, and so maybe that stifles ETF innovation or has some other negative consequences?
Well, you know, I feel like the question of dominance and the question of innovation are two separate questions. In terms of dominance, I think we're getting to a situation where the due diligence burden is back on the client, right? Because if you have, if you're in a relationship where your broker, your advisor, and your asset manager are all one and the same, and they're all recommending in-house products, then, you know, you have to do due diligence on the entire ecosystem, and probably the best place to start on that is by looking at the product and seeing if the recommendations that you're getting for the product actually match given what's, you know, available in the competitive landscape. So I do think that there's an increased burden in that regard. Now, as to your question for innovation, you know, I'm not convinced that innovation is really delivering for the client. I think, you know, when we look back on the year, and certainly in that exercise of picking funds, the best fund of 2019 or whatever, very few of those have a clear long-term strategic use in a way that is, you know, cost effective for the client over the long haul. So I'm not overly worried about ETF innovation. I'm worried about the client experience.
Okay, but what about something like ESG? So two of the ETFs that were covered on that Battle of Pundits, as I mentioned, were S&PE, the Xtrackers, S&P 500 ESG ETF, and then SUSL, the iShares ESG version. I guess, are you not a believer in ESG?
I think that there are some incredibly effective ways for investors to influence corporate America. I don't think that a buyer's strike, which is, you know, effectively where you say, well, you know, I will not get my hands dirty by owning a share of this company or that company or the other company, is not an effective way to influence corporate behavior, because you don't even have a seat at the table. And there has to be such a massive number of investors who are all decidedly avoiding the exact same companies for it to have any impact whatsoever on the share price. So I think while, you know, ESG might be a feel-good product for people who can't bear to identify themselves with a company that, you know, they believe to be odious in some way, I think, you know, with proxy voting and flexing your muscle, you know, where it counts in terms of the boardroom and corporate decision making, is a far more effective tool.
Going back to your comment on innovation, you know, look, we've all seen the data on market cap weighted indexing, and it's been very challenging for active managers to beat those benchmark indexes over really any time frame. And if you look at even smart beta products, I think the track record on some of those, it remains to be seen. But isn't innovation ultimately good? Because while market cap may have worked over the past, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, perhaps it's not going to work as well going forward, right? If we go back to, you know, the 1920s or 1940s, there were different ways to invest, and, you know, we continue to evolve. I guess, isn't it possible that what we think is best today may not be the best moving forward, and so therefore we need to continue to innovate and bring these other products to market and see what might work?
I think there's a lot of room for innovation in terms of product structure, right? Remember, the ETF is not even 30 years old yet, right? It's 27 this year, and it has absolutely upended investing in the client experience. So has the information revolution, in which, you know, doing your homework and researching and understanding what your investment options are is about a zillion times easier now than it was 30 years ago. So, you know, I think those two trends are solid, and, you know, if we see additional evolution in terms of information and structure, there could be dramatic improvements. However, you know, in terms of rearranging one's portfolio, you know, buy more of this, buy less of that, play around with your weighting, the math is actually incredibly simple. So every time a manager takes a bet away from the overall market, and I really don't care in this argument whether the manager is, you know, active with an army of research analysts or is a smart beta manager or, you know, any of the myriad strategies that are out there. But anytime there's a bet taken away from the market, there is another market participant who has the equal and opposite bet. Only one of them will be right. And over time, you know, because of slippage and expenses, the net expected return to the active bet is zero minus the expenses, including slippage. So, you know, are there going to be some portfolios that are very well positioned when the next major market regime shift comes? Absolutely. Is that something that one can predict in advance? Seems unlikely. And is, you know, what worked in the last round going to work in the next round? Also seems unlikely.
Do you think ETF providers are overestimating their ability to get higher fees from some of these quote-unquote differentiated products? I think about the title of your piece. It does include ESG and active management. And I think maybe some issuers might think the fee pressure isn't as pronounced here, but that's not what you found, correct?
Yeah. You know, what I found was really remarkable that, you know, while certainly, like, take the equity space where we've seen vanilla funds, those, you know, the boringest of the boring, drop by 1 basis point a year over the past few years. We've seen the quote-unquote smart beta funds drop by 5 basis points, and we've seen the active funds drop by 11. So while all of those are, you know, starting from a higher price point, they are all marching downwards, and the higher the starting point, the faster the decline. And it gets even more dramatic when you kind of break things down by strategy. So, for example, over the course of the year in 2019, you had ESG funds, asset-weighted expense ratio, drop from 27 basis points down to 21. You had multi-factor funds drop from 44 down to 41. So, you know, while I do think differentiation can buy some time for an asset manager, I think that's all it can do.
What about on the non-transparent active ETFs we were discussing earlier? So we'll see where these launch. I know T. Rowe Price has come out with the fees on several of these that are priced right around the level of their institutional mutual fund share class. But what's your expectation price-wise on these? And you know, do you think we'll see fee pressure here as well?
I think we're already seeing fee pressure here. And I think you can take a real sort of case study from the existing ETFs that are transparent and active. There's a whole mess of them. And what I did in my piece is I really drilled down into the actively managed ETFs that are in the U.S. size and style segments, because that's where the current exemptive relief is going to allow the non-transparent active to operate. If you sort of take out the funds that don't really have a stock picker at the helm, they're actively managed because of esoteric reasons at the SEC of why they have to file that way, you're basically kind of left with two groups. You're left with the ones that have a dedicated funding source, generally an affiliated owner relationship, and those that have to go out there and pound the pavement to attract assets. And in that latter group, you know, if you took a look at the funds that had outflows versus inflows, the funds with outflows had an asset-weighted management fee of 59 basis points, and the ones with inflows, 43. So I think, you know, first of all, that is a huge gap, right? 16 basis points between the winners and the losers. If I were looking at this space and trying to price a product, I would not necessarily stop my discussion with, you know, what are the prices of the other funds that I'm already offering to my existing clients. I would say, what is going on in the ETF marketplace today? And the answer there is very clear. Come in at 40 basis points or under, or you're losing.
Do you think the fund companies are sort of prepared for that environment? I know Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas likes to call the ETF space the terror dome from the ETF issuer's perspective. But do you think, you know, I think about some of the companies that maybe don't have an ETF presence now, but will with a non-transparent ETF. Do you think they're prepared for the terror dome?
I do not think they are. I think that was one of the features that became quite clear at Inside ETFs, is that the learning curve for the new entrants who are coming from this older mutual fund world is pretty steep, and some of them are going to have to learn by doing, and some of the lessons may be, well, from the school of life.
Well, Elizabeth, I think that's probably the perfect note to end on. Excellent perspective this week. So glad we could finally connect, and let's certainly do this again down the road.
It would be my pleasure to do this again, Nate. Thank you so much for inviting me today and for this really exciting conversation.
Well, thank you. That was Elizabeth Kashner, Director of ETF Research at FactSet.
So glad we're all back together and stuff. This is great, man. to know about the party after the show? Aw, oh, man, it's going to be the best. I'm so stoked. Take it easy, bro.
All right, I'm now joined by Tony Wenzel, co-founder and president of Brandometry. They power the index behind the Brand Value ETF, ticker symbol BVAL, B-V-A-L, that seeks to own companies with strong brands that might be currently undervalued by the market. Tony is on the line with me from Seattle. Tony, great reconnecting. Glad to have you on the show this week.
Thanks for having me. I'm grateful.
Okay, so let's first talk about the index itself, and then I definitely want to get into the investment rationale. I just think there's some really interesting angles to this approach. So walk us through the index. How exactly is this designed?
So it's designed to be a kind of a reversion to mean index, and what that means is that we expect certain things to happen over and over again. Most people in the value space are buy and hold for dear life forever, and we're kind of more of a rotation. And the way it works is it revolves around this idea of brand. So about 87% of the value of the S&P 500 is in tangible assets. So if you subtract book value from market value, you can get to that very quickly. And the largest chunk of intangibles is brand. Brand represents about 14 to 21% of most companies in the S&P 500. So we wanted to look at a different metric and say, hey, is there a way for us to capitalize on understanding this piece that, you know, you can't find it on the financial statements, that you have to find it in a different way. Brand is measured in a qualitative way. So you have to do that through surveys and get people's mind share about so different things. So you could take this qualitative measurement, and we use these brand signals that we get from a company called Core Brand. Core Brand does about 10,000 surveys a year, and they interview C-level people, highly educated people, people that do or could do business with the companies that they're interviewing about, right? So the target companies. They have three categories of questions that they ask people. One is about the strength of one category is about the strength of the management team. A second category is about the strength of the overall reputation of the company, and the third category is whether whether the respondent would invest in the company. So they're asking some pretty interesting questions that they kind of take the answers from this survey. And there's many, many questions. Those are just the categories of the questions. And they score the answers somewhere between 1 and 100. And like most surveys, there's going to be some central tendency. To qualify for our index, you have to be a strong brand. So we seek undervalued strong brands. And strong brands have to score over a 60 out of 100 or better to be considered strong. So that's the qualitative piece, or what we would call the numerator. Our denominator is the share price. So we're looking at the change, the delta of brand strength over the delta of share price in any given year. And so we look at share price as the brand strength as the numerator, share price as the denominator, and we're looking for the biggest gaps between brands that are super strong and have an underweight, a light share price. So we take the top 50, we hold them in equal weight. We balance it annually in September. We tend to show better performance than the S&P 500 historically, with lower volatility, better dividend yield, and very strong ESG scores. So does that give you what you need?
Yeah, so you mentioned the S&P 500. What is the starting universe of stocks that you then whittle down using this process of focusing on brands?
It is really the S&P 500 now.
Okay.
At one point they were looking at 1,000 different companies, but they've realized that so they're all U.S. large cap companies, and they are all or ADRs, and at this point they're all the S&P 500.
And just taking a step back, can you go into a little more detail? Why focus on brands specifically?
So, yeah, again, brand represents 14 to 21% of the value of most companies. So, the biggest chunk of intangibles is brand. And so that's brand is really this collection of things like that companies invest in, like R&D and marketing and customer support and advertising and sales. So it's this collection of perceptions about the company and their people, their ideas and their conduct. And it represents such a large chunk. If it were a line item on the balance sheet, it would be the biggest one. It would be bigger than, you know, plant, property, and equipment. You know, it would be. So we feel like its brand is one of those things that is just not looked at anymore. People don't, or ever really hasn't ever really been looked at. And, you know, you can't financialize it in a simple way.
Without getting too far into the accounting weeds, I know this can get a bit hairy, but can you explain why brand value isn't fully reflected on a company's balance sheet?
Well, there's just no way to measure it, you know, and so there's two different sides to this. When companies are generating intangible assets, they make intangible investments, and they invest in things, and most of that investment happens in private, and there's good reason for that, because these things are generally ideas, right? They're intellectual property, they're distribution, they're things you don't want your competitors to know about. So you're investing this money, and there's no real way for outsiders to track how those investments are going, right? You can't just look inside and say, oh, they're investing this much in their distribution network. You might look at Amazon and say, okay, they're trying to build a network for literally distribution at Amazon. But you want to pull back and say, okay, what does that really mean long term in a company this size? But so when a company buys another company, they actually see that realized in this thing called, you know, this transactional idea called goodwill, which is what you pay more than the market value. Am I answering your question? I don't know if I nailed it.
Yeah, no. Well, okay, so intangible assets, you mentioned they comprise 87% of the S&P 500's market value, correct?
That's right.
And I think I saw a stat that back in the 1970s, that number was around 15 to 20%. So why have intangible assets and brands become such a bigger component of market value?
Yeah, the economy shifted, and it kind of happened slowly at first, and then suddenly. You know, after Apple, when Apple became a public company in what, 75, 76, it was a very low portion of a balance sheet was intangible, and if you look at it now, it's kind of flipped. So people are more, companies are in the business of generating ideas more than they are in the business of creating super high efficiencies with production.
In terms of determining if a brand is undervalued, I think you've made it really clear how you're measuring brands and certainly why they're important, but explain more what exactly will then make them undervalued. Is it just simply the gap between the brand value and then the market value of a company whenever that's widest?
So, yeah, I mean, we're looking at the year-over-year change in their brand value, which is going to be slower. You know, there's not going to have the same volatility, if you will, that the year-over-year that the year-over-year change in their stock price would have. So you normalize some of that to make sure that, you know, you're looking at the same scale. But the thrust is that, you know, companies, they lose traction for some reason. They get bruised, and then they come back. And that's the kind of rotation we're counting on.
Can you give us a couple of examples of companies in the index that you show as having undervalued brands right now? Maybe companies that you find particularly interesting.
Yeah, so I wanted to. We have on our website, www.brandometry.net, a piece called A Decade of Capturing Undervalued Brands. And what it is it looks at the last 10 years of who's delivered the most returns to the company. Last year, the top three were Apple, Starbucks, and Estee. Apple, everyone talks about, so let's skip them. But Starbucks, you know, is an interesting company here in Seattle. You can't say it isn't, right? I have to say that. I'm bound by law. But so they're trading at like $88. They're up like $2 today, I think. And they're a company that probably isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And they have a strong brand. People don't go get coffee. They say they meet at Starbucks. I find that a really interesting, you know, they've been in and out of the index, and they've generated returns. They did pretty well in 2018, too. They returned almost 45% return to the index last year. Another one down the list from there is Estee. Estee has done an amazing job. They've been in and out of the index and a top performer repeatedly, you know, like five of the last 10 years. And they're trading at about 200 right now, and I think they're up about $4 today. Again, another kind of a strong brand that just seems to continue to grow and continue to produce returns in an amazing way. Now, there's a lot of risk, I guess, with them if you say, you know, the coronavirus, they do a lot of business in China. But, you know, those are two really interesting companies that did really well for us last year.
Going back to the actual evaluation of a company's brand, as you were describing earlier, one of the reasons brands aren't currently reflected on balance sheets is their value is difficult to measure, right? They're intangible. This isn't easy. I guess my question is, There are other firms out there, I'm sure, trying to quantify a company's brand value. Why do you think your approach is better?
Well, I think quantifying, it's interesting, but, you know, the relative quantification that we're doing, I think, is important. And look, any new information is good information. When you when you're an astronomer and you're looking at stars that are far away and trying to figure out how far away they are, you use a whole toolkit of things. So I know how far this is, so I know how far that is, and you can triangulate in on the things. So all new information, I think, is good, provided it's measuring what it seeks to measure. But I think what we're doing is we're taking this idea that brands come back, that they come back to life. They seldom disappear off the planet, and we're trying to invest in them. People will say, what happens if, you know, there's a horrible event? And we'll say, well, that sounds like a pretty good opportunity to me, right? You know, Volkswagen isn't going anywhere, or, is Chipotle going to disappear? Probably not. Now, we're banking on the fact that strong brands are going to be resilient.
Well, that brings up a good point. What is the biggest risk to this approach? Is it quantifying the value of brands and perhaps being wrong on that? Is it the potential for a company's brand to be tarnished overnight? Because, you know, I do think of something like, I don't know, Boeing with a 737 MAX or something like that. Boeing's there in Seattle. And then obviously, even if you have a good brand, that doesn't guarantee success, right? So what's the biggest risk with this strategy?
Yeah, I think there is a sense, particularly the naysayers that we run into have this idea that with millennials and Generation Y, that brand isn't as important as it once was. And I would say, well, two things. One, there are more brands than ever, so I don't know if that's true. And number two, I would kind of take issue with that. Number two, brands have historically lived a really, really long time in the American psyche, and I don't feel like they're going to disappear anytime soon.
This ETF does have value in its name. Do you consider this a value approach to investing? Because I'm sure, as you're aware, there's been a lot of debate recently over whether traditional company valuation metrics like price to book, that they're outdated, right? Because they don't fully capture the value of intangible
assets.
Right,
and that's part of the thrust of what, you know, our program.
So do you agree? I mean, is this a value approach to investing?
It straddles sometimes and becomes kind of a blend of growth and value, but this year Morningstar's calling us value. So I do think we're a value, again, a value investment. I do think we produce returns, generally, historically, a little bit better than the S&P 500, even though we're only a fraction of that universe, like 10% of it. And we produce these amazing ESG scores, which is one of those things that is a big deal today. Again, if brand isn't important, ESG isn't important, right? They're just ideas.
Okay, so for investors who are interested in this approach, how do you see this strategy being used in a portfolio?
Yeah, so I think it's a way to invest in the S&P 500. With a little less volatility. I think it could be part of your core if if you consider yourself a core holder of these sorts of products. It does tend to produce alpha as well. So a lot of people have put it in the satellites. We have one big group out of New Jersey that considers it growth, so they're putting it in their core as part of their growth core. I don't want to proselytize, but I think there's a lot of different unique ways you can use something that produces alpha like this.
Well, Tony, great stuff this week. I think a really interesting strategy. Appreciate you joining me. I'm sure we'll chat again soon. Thank you.
Thanks for your time. I'm super grateful, and congratulations to you guys and the Chiefs.
Thank you. That was Tony Wenzel, co-founder and president of Brandometry. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, I'll be joined by State Street's Matt Bartolini. We're going to discuss an ETF that has received a lot of attention recently, the Spider S&P Dividend ETF. Along with that, we'll also talk common ETF myths or misperceptions. And then Brad Ball, CEO of Liquid Strategies and portfolio manager of Overlay Shares, will spotlight their unique ETF lineup. Until then, have a great week, everyone.